Welcome to Bread and Milk. I'm Naomi Devlin and I'll be taking you on a soothing ramble through the food memories and life stories of some of my favourite people. Cleona Prendergast is one of those polymaths who are completely unassuming. Her beautiful writing and photography evoke a sense of contentment with a life well lived. They'll make you want to throw on an Aran jumper and hike along the coast of Connemara where she lives. A Ballymallow trained chef, without being remotely chefy, she prefers to let the produce speak for itself. Her food is the essence of simplicity. A sea swimmer whose name is Of the Sea, she lives in a house in the woods by a lake with her children and husband. It's kind of a bit of a fairy tale. She's a treasure and I loved speaking with her. You'll find information on where to find Cleona online in the show notes.
Am I very loud by any chance?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Am I very loud?
No.
Oh my God, now we sound like a pair of old women. So Cleona, so the very first thing I have to clear up is the pronunciation of your name, which I agonized over, having many Irish relatives myself with crazy names, or not crazy names, just names that I don't understand because I don't speak Gaelic, and yet because I'm Irish, people expect me to.
No, but, they're pretty crazy names.
Okay, that's fine. But Cleona is a beautiful name, as long as you actually know how to pronounce it, because anyone who sees it written would not pronounce it that way.
No, it's C-L-I-O-D-H-N-A, which is extremely confusing. But you pronounce it absolutely brilliantly as Cleona.
I came to you through Instagram, which is my route to lots of beautiful and wonderful people. And I hadn't realised for quite a while that we almost grew up in exactly the same way and were kind of, it feels like we were just separated by the sea, the Arab Sea.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, just in terms of, so I grew up in a commune and very much just learning from the land and foraging, and that's how I learned to cook. And you grew up in a hotel.
Yes, yeah, on the coast, yeah.
Yeah.
Only about 15 minutes from where, 10 minutes really from where I live now.
Same, exactly the same for me. So I've come back to where I grew up. But that you found your love of food really through that early kind of immersion in it. You know, and there's a story about your dad kind of wheeling you out to eat oysters because you were a child that would eat oysters. You know, I just think that's fantastic. So... and when we talked about your food memories, of which I know you have many, 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 because you have been connected with food since you were tiny, absolutely tiny, the theme that came up for you was mushrooms. And so I just thought today that would be great to explore your connection with mushrooms, because they are such a thing that both delights and frightens people. And so tell me how you came to love mushrooms.
Well, I do remember when I was very little, my sister didn't like mushrooms. And so I didn't like mushrooms because she didn't like mushrooms. I may not have even bothered trying them at that point, but anything she didn't like, I didn't like. But during the summer, I went to stay on my uncle and aunt's farm in Mayo. It was probably my mother getting me out of the way in the middle of the very busy season. And I remember getting up at about 5:30 in the morning with the whole family, my uncle and my aunt and their three children, and going to pick field mushrooms. I wasn't very impressed at getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I really didn't see the point of, I didn't think it was that special to be going out to pick mushrooms. But we gathered up baskets and baskets of them and brought them back to the house, and my aunt cooked them on her agar. And I have, just with butter, I have never in my life tasted anything so delicious. Mm. It was just mind-blowing. And that is my, like, I have lots of food memories before that, but I think, I really do think it's the first time my mind was blown by something, you know?
Wow. Blown by the kind of actual flavour of it? Or do you think it was something about the whole experience of getting up early and the actual finding them, you know, like treasures in the grass?
I certainly think that was true. And I really believe that even more so since. But I think it was the surprise of this delicious. I mean, field mushrooms are so different to mushrooms you buy in the supermarket. There's just this, I'll never, ever, ever forget the flavour of those. It really transported me. And it really, I think it was just the surprise that they were just so divine. And suddenly I got the whole, I realised why they were getting up at half past five in the morning to go and get the mushrooms, because it was just, it just made, it all made sense to me. And yes, I did enjoy the experience in the field, but it was that moment where I really just took a mouthful that my mind was blown.
That's amazing, isn't it? Because as a child, how old did you say you were?
I don't remember exactly. I think I was probably about 7 or 8.
Yeah, because that's young, isn't it? I mean, because usually children at that age are concerned with, like, protecting their kind of palate from new flavors, and so they they're kind of collapsing anything that's weird and making everything smaller, and, you know, I'll just have toast and I'll just have fish fingers, or, you know, whatever it is. And so something in you is really prepared to open up to the wonder of something new.
Well, I was always pretty good at that, I think, probably because of the hotel and being surrounded by food and chefs and things all the time. I was certainly much better than my sister was, but she did influence me in a few ways and the things I didn't like. But I got over that pretty quickly. I think food wise, I just seemed to have an open mind, I think.
Yeah.
But we all did, really, in our house. And there weren't very many things my sister didn't eat either. There were just a couple of things.
So you were kind of house full of foodies.
I don't know whether it was that we weren't allowed not to eat things.
Well, that's true, isn't it? I mean, that does encourage you to be, you know, to just get on with it. I know with my son, I was always really clear. Look, if it's good for you, you'll eat it, you know, or don't eat it, but don't, you know, you won't be having something like cornflakes instead.
So it does encourage
that kind of, oh, well, this is food. This is all good food. I see other people eating and enjoying it, you know. And kids are very influenced by what's going on around them, aren't they?
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, we ate quite differently during the summer and during the winter. So we had my mother's home cooking during the winter, because the hotel was closed in the winter, apart from we might do small groups of people. But, and so during the summer, everyone was really busy. And so we ate whatever was in the hotel, which was really nice, obviously. But we all craved the winter and my mother's cooking. So it was quite different. It was a funny way to be, you know.
And what was it about her cooking that you craved?
I think probably the simplicity of it, that you know, all summer long there were kind of more complicated things, not overly complicated, but in a commercial kitchen, even though it was a small family run hotel, you're trying to do different things with food, whereas during the winter, you know, our favorite thing, and my, to this day, my favorite thing is a roast chicken, just plain roast chicken. And I think it also came with the fact that they were around, they weren't busy, we had time, we were in our house as opposed to being in the hotel all the time. They were both connected, but we spent the whole time in the hotel during the summer. So I think it might have been a part of that, that this was home time and it was home food.
Yeah, soothing, comfort food, isn't it?
Yeah,
So roast chicken, yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Sometimes the simplest things are, I remember something my mother, and my mother is a terrible cook. I mean, I think it's partially the reason I became a cook is because you'd open the kitchen cupboards and moths would fly out,
Oh, so
And
funny.
but one thing she used to make, which I think is quite an Irish thing, is we would have wheaten bread, brown soda bread. With what Reni Redzepi calls tooth butter, which means butter you can see your teeth in.
Yes,
Yeah.
excellent.
Kerrygold, and then a sprinkling of sugar, and then she would cut that up and pour warm milk on it. And we'd eat that.
So I never knew any, we didn't have that as kids, but
Okay.
a friend of mine, they used to call that goody.
Okay,
So it was
goody.
like, yeah, goody. That was the treat.
All the good things. Yeah,
Yeah.
some bread, some sugar, some butter, some milk. Yeah. So, but I remember that it was, it's the kind of food that is not glamorous, but it is just, it touches everything in terms of comfort. And, it's not, you couldn't put your finger on it and say, oh, yeah, it was great because it had this incredible aroma or whatever. But it's just that represents being at home, being in a safe place, being, having what you need around you.
We were very fortunate in that we had a really good kitchen in the hotel. My mother didn't cook in the kitchen during the summer. She was kind of more reception and out front, and my dad would have been in the dining room, the bar and things. And we had a series of really good chefs. Margaret Cronin, actually, who's a woman she has a pub in Liscannor, in Clare, or in Ballybawn. She was the one who kind of, I used to love hanging around the kitchen. I just loved the atmosphere in there. And she just kind of said, well, you're not allowed to be in here unless you have. And so she got me started on cooking. And I remember ice cream was my thing. So I'd make the creme. She taught me how to make the creme anglaise and I'd make the ice cream.
Amazing.
But then a couple of years later, and he was there for a good few years and then went away and came back again, a chef by the name of Owen Davis came to work, and he was exceptional. He was of a different era. At that point, that would have been in maybe the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And yeah, early 90s, I think. He was foraging for stuff then. And nobody was foraging for stuff, certainly not in Ireland at that stage. And so he was great guy at getting everyone else to do things for him as well.
Perfect.
So he would send me off to get the nettles, I think was my first thing. And I went up the back and I'd get the nettles. And I was kind of intrigued by all of this, but really didn't think it was going to be great. And so he made a nettle soup and it was divine, absolutely gorgeous. And so I think his ability, one, to know about the things that were forageable, but also then to be able to create something amazing with it. So it wasn't like somebody who didn't know coming back to try and make something with something they had foraged that really didn't turn out that well. What he did was just incredible. And so from there, it was the nettles. Earlier in the spring, it would have been the wild garlic. We would have done a lot of seaweed foraging and then mushrooms. And so mushrooms is probably the last thing on the list, because obviously it took a lot more learning.
Yeah. So did you learn about, because that's always the thing with mushrooms, isn't it? Is will this poison me?
Well, so even to this day, I don't pick all the mushrooms I don't know, and there are plenty of mushrooms I don't, but I know what grows in my area that I can eat. And I think that's the important thing for people. I think just picking everything and bringing it back and trying to figure out what's what is really difficult because lots of them look alike and it's quite dangerous. So certainly going with him to find out about the ones I could eat, then that was all I had to focus on. And I didn't worry about the rest of them. And subsequently over the years, I kind of found more. With different people and things like that, but that that really honed it in. And all of those little foraging trips and going out to pick things, I enjoyed so much. So that was definitely a part of a part of loving the foraging aspect of it, but loving the food as well. And then, you know, bringing that now to where I live now, I actually live in the woods now on a lake, which is, yes, right beside the coast, but I'm surrounded by woods everywhere. And, you know, come, well, June, maybe even May sometimes, but early June, you'll have the golden chanterelles. And then later on in the season, right up until Christmas, you have the trumpet chanterelles, or what we used to call yellow legs. They were brown on top, the little yellow foot. And they are everywhere.
Amazing. And so you would have to pay so much money for them if you were buying them in a shop, wouldn't you? I mean, they're proper, you know, high-end food.
Absolutely. And I mean, we literally go out in our pyjamas and pick the mushrooms.
I was going to say, do you put a red cloak on and with a little basket?
We have the little basket, but we haven't got the red cloak. But that's what I love with my kids as well, is doing that. And they loved it when they were tiny. Then they got a bit bored with it later. And then, well, I still have one who loves doing it. But I remember, which is even a couple of years ago, I said to somebody that I'd bring them mushroom picking. And I got caught up and I couldn't go. So I just turned to Jake, who's now 15. So he was, what, 13 maybe at the time. And I just said, would you take these two people out foraging for me? And he was like, oh, you know, and I knew he knew everything better than I knew it myself. So I had no problem there. And so he went up and collected them and walked them down through the woods. And that's where it all came out. So when he's with me, he'd be going, oh, Mum, for God's sake, you know. But with them, he could show them everything. They were just, they just couldn't believe it. And I was quite surprised as well, because he just doesn't do that with me. But he, you know, they came back with about six different varieties of mushrooms, and we lit a little fire in the woods and we cooked them up out there, and it was just magical. It was really, really lovely.
Well, there's that thing, isn't there? I mean, I've talked about this before in the podcast, but about eating the thing that's grown in the place where you are, you know. And so eating mushroom in the woods, or a fish at the seaside, or a peach under a peach tree, you know, that something about or I mean, the Japanese talking about forest bathing, you know, that you get you walk in the forest, you get all these essential oils and the smell of the you know, the wood and the leaf mulch, and you know, it's like all of that somehow makes it more, doesn't it?
Oh, it absolutely does. And sometimes you're not even aware of those aspects that are doing you so well. But I totally believe in the forest bathing. I go up and sit in the woods sometimes, and you know, particularly during the winter, when everything else, there's no colour anywhere, it's still bright green up there with the moss, and there are spruce trees all around me. We still have a few little beech and other hardwood trees, but it's mainly a spruce wood that was planted by our forestry department. It used to be, it belonged to Quilcha, which was the government owned forestry, and so we bought a little tract of land in there, and so, you know, the moss and the ferns and everything are still all there right now. They're all it's still bright green up there. It's just so beautiful.
Amazing.
And it really does you, it just does something to you. I can't even explain it. It's like a little piece of magic.
Yeah, so absolutely. Do you have a favorite mushroom that you collect then? You say they kind of change obviously through the season, but have one you look forward to?
I look forward to them all. I get so excited. I mean, I get ridiculously excited, particularly when the golden chanterelles come out first, or girole, if you like. There's so many different names. Which is also the problem when you're foraging.
Yes, you don't know which ones they are, which name to go by.
Yeah.
But you love them all.
Yeah, I know. I really do get so excited, but so they come out first, so that's a great thing, because that's the first flush of the summer, and that's very exciting.
Is that, do they come out in the summer? So they're not on autumn?
The Girolds, yes, will come out. And they'll stay until, we don't have a huge amount of them now. But you could get those up until September. They'd be waning in October. You may or may not get them.
Yeah.
Okay. But they would come out. I've seen them as early as late May. Mm. Definitely June.
Mm. Okay. Gosh, that's so early, isn't
yeah,
it? But
yeah,
I guess
yeah.
If you have a woods, then you've got that kind of nice, moist, dark environment, you know.
Yes, I suppose. Yes, I suppose that's it. And you know, we have a lot of moisture, obviously.
You have.
And so then they just need a little bit of sunshine. And once the sun comes, if they've had a moist enough start, they yeah. just seem to pop up. And it's
gosh,
really
that's,
great.
That's a long season. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And do you, so if you're surrounded by a lot of them, do you just eat them as you go, or do you preserve them in some way?
So, well, with the yellow chanterelles or the Girolds, we eat them as we go because there's so few of them.
Mm.
Then it's so that then we have the trumpet chanterelles that come a little bit later, and so that really is September-ish time. Mm. You might find a few seps as well, but usually they're in bits by the time I find them. They're just
okay.
You know, they come up very quickly, and the slugs and flies are in them you know, immediately,
and they don't know what they're eating.
No. Or maybe they do.
Oh, maybe, yeah. Italian.
Yeah, they know how good they know how good it is. But it's the trumpets, really, I do a lot of preserving with those, but mainly drying. Because the flavor, like, they're really nice when you eat them fresh, but the flavor just intensifies so much when they're dried as well. And that's what I kind of preserve them in butter sometimes as well, because it's a great one for just putting in the freezer. So I cook them with a little bit of garlic and maybe chop them up, and then mix them through softened butter, and then roll it up and stick it in the freezer. But like, roll it up in a little like a long sweet.
Yeah. If you like. Yeah, yeah.
And a little bit of greaseproof paper. And then you can just cut a bit of that off to kind of put on a steak or put in a bit of risotto or on a bit of pasta or something like that. Cut it when it's frozen.
Yes, yes.
And that really holds that lovely fresh flavour for a long time.
Ah, okay,
that's
so
really
you get
good.
Fresh rather than drying it. So that is a different flavour.
It's very different, yeah, okay. But it's lovely.
Yes.
And then later on, I would, like, before, you know, I'd gather them all. So as I'm gathering, I'd eat them and then I'd dry some.
Yeah.
But I've got an agave in the house, so it's really great for drying. They dry in a couple of days, so you just leave them anywhere beside a radiator or dry, just as long as they have enough air around them as well.
Yeah.
And I dry bucket loads of them, and I make my kind of favourite thing, which is like a chicken broth. Now, you can do it with vegetables as well very easily. And just really simple chicken broth. I don't put any other vegetables other than onion in my chicken broth, because I think it's
too sweet.
Makes it too sweet, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You're the only one I've ever come across that agrees with me on that.
Oh, okay, I'm with you.
But just and then around this time of the year as well, or maybe a bit later, I gather some nori on the beach. Lots of that seaweed, and wow. So or what they it's actually called, there's a few different names for it.
Pyoria something, isn't it?
I'm never good with the scientific names.
I think Pyoria is what the Mad King had, where he had blue wee.
Oh, so,
but it's a similar name, because I always think that's my hook for it. But anyway, yeah, nori is easy to remember. Or lava bread.
Or lava, that's right. Here they do, in Irish, they call it Shlaivach and Shlaunach. I've heard it pronounced both ways. I think Shlaunach is probably the proper way, but I have heard people call it Shlaivach. And it always seems so appropriate, because it's so slippy on the rocks, and you know, it's kind of flat.
Okay.
So it's sliding
around.
It just sounds like
Shlaunach.
Exactly. So I gather a lot of that and dry that. As I said, now all the way up to Easter. And so I use then the dried mushrooms, chicken broth or vegetable broth, and the seaweed, and that's it. And just maybe some salt, lots of salt.
Oh, Wow.
And it's just, it. It's a cure-all. I really think that there's just so much goodness in it.
So, well, I mean, there really is, isn't there? Yeah, you know, you've not just the umami, but you've got all the minerals and the seaweed.
And all the umami, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. But umami does something, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, they say that it's satisfying. So food without umami isn't satisfying the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think of just eating a boiled potato on its own or whatever, you know, it has that flatness to it. Yeah. So I guess that's...
It's so true. So true.
And I think you said you make a powder as well, do you, out of your
mushrooms? Yes, again, when they're dried, sometimes I'll whiz them. Actually, I've got a Nutribullet that I appropriated from my brother.
Yeah.
I don't know if he knows I have it.
Don't tell him now. The secret's out.
Yeah. And I rarely use it for fruit juice because I find it a bit too thick, but I use it all the time for spices and things like that. And it does a brilliant job of powdering the dried seaweed and the mushrooms. And so you can have this fine dust that you can sprinkle over things, which is lovely. You know,
umami dust.
And so, you know, like that, if sometimes if you leave the mushrooms in that broth with the seaweed for a little while, the kind of flavors come out a little bit more. But if you want something instant, the powder really has this instant flavor. So I'd sprinkle a bit of that in there or on lots of other things as well.
I mean, I've yet to find something I think that powder doesn't enhance. In fact, you can buy it in Waitrose now.
And there's an Irish company making it as well.
It's probably, it probably all comes from your woods. I mean, I make a vegan broth, and the thing that kind of elevates it is adding so I also have a little coffee grinder that I blitz everything I can find in. And I'll blitz up slippery elm and marshmallow root and mushrooms into a kind of powder, and then it makes it really thick, so you get the kind of thick texture. But it's the mushroom umami that I think when you cut out all meat and fish and dairy, that because the sources of umami are then kind of, you know, lessened, aren't they, to garlic and onions and mushrooms and tomato, maybe, you know, that's your kind of main ones, and seaweed. That getting those into your food just seems to make it so rich and
it really packs a punch, doesn't it? That's when you know you've got it, I think.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That it tastes, has a taste. And have you ever tried, because I never have actually tried fermenting mushrooms. I ferment everything else.
Yeah, it doesn't really appeal to me somehow.
Yeah, because I know people make kind of ketchup or garums.
I should make a garum. I have been meaning to do that and I haven't done
it. I mean, like a nori and mushroom garum would be
That's it. I'm gonna do it now.
I shamed you into it. I mean, but it's that kind of fear of the funky, you know, when you smelled a mushroom that's gone bad in the the bottom of the fridge. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, they are quite spectacular, aren't they?
It's on your fingers for days, isn't it?
Particularly if there's seps or things like that, where they're, there's a lot of water in them. You're like,
yes, so strongly flavoured. Yeah. So that's always the thing. But I think that's fermenting anything that has got a lot of umami in it. That's what you're risking, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's the mushrooms in kind of vinegar or liquid just doesn't. That doesn't really do it for me.
In terms of flavour or is it the texture?
Flavour and texture, it doesn't appeal to me really. I rarely use them, in fact. So, it doesn't do it for me.
Me neither. There's something about that. Well, also, I think when you preserve, I mean, as a fermenter, I'm probably going to get on my high horse now, but as a fermenter, there's a subtlety to lactic acid that you don't get with acetic acid, which is vinegar. Mm-hmm. And so when you take these, although mushrooms are kind of richly flavoured, it's still quite a delicate flavour, isn't it? And you whack it with a load of acetic acid, and then that's all you taste. And the texture that you've got is slimy. So, it's such an odd kind of idea.
I'm sure somebody out there loves it, but you know.
But they're wrong.
And it's a big Eastern European thing. They always pickle their mushrooms.
Well, they do a lot of preserving in oil and vinegar anyway, yeah, don't they? Yeah, agrodolce, yeah. So, yeah, I guess it is just a different palate.
And you know what? You get used to all those things.
Yeah.
The more you eat them, I mean, your palate completely changes towards them. So maybe I should give them another go.
Oh, you've got lots of projects now to go away in.
Yeah.
I would go with the garum. I think that's the one.
The other thing we do get here, which I forgot to mention, are amethyst deceivers.
Which you
rarely gather a huge amount of them, but they're so exciting to see this like purple craziness. And then to know you can eat it is really fantastic.
You can eat them, okay.
Oh, you can, yeah.
Because usually if something's called a deceiver, it means it's poisonous, you know.
No, you can eat them. And actually last year we had a huge crop of them. Well, huge, much bigger than before.
Okay.
Much bigger than I've ever seen.
Wow.
But they're a real thrill for the kids as well. They just for anybody actually, anyone I bring out, it's
purple
just
potatoes.
So crazy, yeah. I haven't found that they have an amazing flavor. They're nice to eat, but there isn't a very distinctive flavor from them, I find. Mm.
But do they keep their color when you cook them?
They don't even keep their color when you cut them. After a couple of minutes, they kind of start to lose the purpleness. They're still a bit purple, but no, they turn brown then.
Okay, so yeah, like an apple.
When you cook them, they're gone. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
yeah. So it
or
is
like your purple sprouting broccoli that disappears to
funny.
Green.
Yes, yeah. Okay. So you really need to kind of see them raw to appreciate what you're eating.
Yeah, I mean, in a couple of seconds, the color starts to go.
Gosh, how interesting! Mm. Yeah. Well, I've never seen them here. So that,
have you
that
not,
must
no,
be a
yeah.
No, never ever seen it. I mean, you wouldn't miss a purple mushroom, would you?
Yeah, but they can be really tiny as well. Sometimes sometimes they grow to, let's say, maybe an inch in diameter of the cap. Hmm. But often they're much, much smaller than that. Hmm. They'd be the size of your baby finger.
Right. So you really need to be in the zone.
Yeah.
You know, going
the mushroom eyes is what my kids call it. So particularly with the trumpet chanterelles, you know, you go up and you can't see anything at all because the leaves on the ground and everything else are the same color, you know. Mm. And then you see one and suddenly you realize they're all around you.
How
so you've got you get your mushroom eyes on there.
Yes. Well, I know this probably isn't something I should admit, but we used to pick a lot of magic mushrooms when I was younger, growing up in a commune, and it would be exactly the same thing. You'd be in a field and, you know, because they have a very specific shape, they have a little nipple on top.
Yeah.
And there are mushrooms that grow on dung that have a rounded top that look the same, but without the nipple. So you're looking, you're looking for nipples in the grass. and you would be looking, and then suddenly you'd realize you were standing in a kind of ring of them, you know, and you'd be down on your hands and knees.
There
like
you
a little
go.
Truffle pig.
There you go.
So it really sounds like your kind of palate is informed by very much by what's around you, but also I get whenever I see your food, there's a kind of authentic simplicity to it. It's like you're not trying to be fancy, or you know, you're just saying, look at this beautiful thing, you know, and I put this next to it. And then so where did that come from?
I don't know, and I do always describe myself as a very simple cook. I think it has to do with probably growing up here, and maybe influence from all those people who passed in and out of the kitchens over the years. But we've got really, really, really good food around here. We don't have a great variety of food, as in we have all the shellfish and seafood imaginable. We have lamb. We have some beef, not really huge amounts. And then we have all, you know, we just don't get a huge amount of vegetable growing in things. The soil is very poor, and so you don't have cereals and things like that. It's all very boggy and acidic, so it's just very, and very rocky and rushes and all that kind of thing.
So the veg would be more like mushrooms and leaves and
yeah
and maybe roots.
Yes, but I think because I mean our lamb, for example, you know, all the sheep are just wandering practically wild on the hills and things. It's so sweet and incredible. I don't want to do anything to it. You know, same with a lot of the fish. It's just so gorgeous and fresh. You just want a little bit of butter or a little bit of this, that and the other. I really am. I like to be able to taste the flavors of the ingredients themselves rather than like growing up or even as a chef, I rarely cooked with lots of spices and things. And if I did, it'd be kind of one maybe or two, you know. I might do a little bit more of that now, but it's just not my natural way of being because I don't want to cover up the flavor. I want it to be of this place, maybe, I'm not quite sure, but definitely just the simplicity of it. I love the food itself. If that makes any sense, I'm probably not explaining that very, very clearly.
I think that's beautiful, and I think it takes real confidence to see to choose beautiful produce, but also to see that it is beautiful and allow it to be. I think it means that you're inserting your ego into the food much less, you know.
I genuinely I get really excited about the food, not about what I've done to it.
Yes, well, that's I think that's admirable, and that's I know JP McMahon, you know.
Yes, of course.
He's a great advocate of that, isn't he? I mean, obviously he's also a chef as well, so I think he probably has to keep himself in check a bit, but there is that sense that I think in Ireland that you are realizing how incredible the produce is, and that it really sings, you know, it's a little island, it sings of its place. And that is, gosh, I mean, when everything is so homogenous these days, you know, and you can go, I mean, I used to love traveling and you would arrive in a place and it would be, everything would be different. You know, the smells you go to the market and all the produce looks different because they grow different types of vegetable or they have herbs you haven't seen. And actually now everything feels like, certainly in Europe, you know, that it's starting to get homogenized. And so clinging on to that, you know, the things that are literally growing where you are, I think is really, we need it in a kind of, I don't want to go off up my own arse, but we need it in a spiritual way, don't we? That connection to where we are.
Well, I think I certainly feel that. Yeah. Again, maybe mightn't have described it that way, but yes. But it is true, it is kind of spiritual. I mean, it just wouldn't have been a word I would have thought of to go along with it, but it really is. It's an appreciation, I think, of what you have around you. So it's something that comes from inside. It's not something that I go, oh, that's right, we have to eat the food around us and this is whatever. It's something that's grown with me very slowly from a very young age, and it's something I can't shake. Between the mushrooms and everything I find that grows around me, there's some huge excitement in it for me. But I really do think eating the food that grows around you and is produced around you brings you so much closer. And when you're foraging, particularly for things, you're watching out for the seasons. You're going, oh, the blackberries are late this year. Or, the mushrooms need more water. You know, you really become in tune with where you are and your climate and your soil and all of those kind of things. Like, it's even figuring out why are the mushrooms growing here? And they're not growing, 100 yards away in exactly the same habitat. That still confuses me, by the way. But anyway. It just brings it all full circle, brings you down to earth. Really, and it makes you feel a part of nature in some way, which I love.
But but it is the dream, living in the woods in a house you built yourself, full of absolutely gorgeous things by a lake. Come on. You've won the lottery.
Well, I certainly feel like I have most days, yeah.